And here we go again. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. And this is what, as you would have expected, I guess, right? What we're going to be talking about.
Take a look at what happened. Over.
It was only 4 or 5 shots, but really it's the 72 hours that seems to have changed everything. And we're going to take you through it. I'm Rick Sanchez. Get ready for Direct Impact. Let's do this. So let's start with that. As you would imagine, the whole world seems to still be talking about this. Donald Trump just came out and said that by all measures, he is supposed to be dead. He's supposed to be dead. Those are his words. Now, if you're thinking that Mr. Trump has a tendency to exaggerate and overstate things, yes, you would be right, he does. But not in this case. Absolutely not in this case. He is 100% correct when he says that, right? In fact, I'm going to let you play. I'm going to play this video for you again now that the whole world has been watching it. And you'll see what I mean. First, let's take a look at these 30 seconds of what happened. Together, go.
And you know, that's a little bit old, that chart. That chart's a couple of months old. And if you want to really see something that said, take a look at what happened.
Now, I don't know if you were able to see that there, but I think it's remarkable to see the former president essentially turns his head right there at the very moment the bullets were fired. Now, he's looking to the side because he's looking at the screen. See, right there. He's looking at the screen. He had the screen up talking about immigration, as he often does. And as he turns his head, the way I'm doing it right now, this way, that's when the bullet would likely have killed him if he had not turned his head. Think about that. If he's looking straight ahead, he's further back, and there's a real good chance that he would be, well, it would have left him critically injured at worst, right? But instead, because he turns his head, it goes through his ear. A lot of people thought, well, maybe it's a fragment. It wasn't a fragment. It wasn't something the bullet hit and then bounced up and hit him. It wasn't him hurting himself when he went to the ground, as some people had suggested. How do we know this? How do we know the bullet actually hit his ear when it was going by his head? Well, somebody in the audience happened to have a very sophisticated camera, right, with an amazing shutter speed. And they happened to take this photo at the precise moment. I don't know if you can see it there. If not, get a little closer to your TV and you will. There it is. See, that's the trajectory. That's the bullet having gone right through his ear, and it is now turned toward, as he is turned toward the screen, looking at the immigration numbers on the screen. That's amazing, because if you think about it, he's turning, right? So he does this. When he does that, the bullet goes there. If he's still like this, the bullet goes there. It's fascinating to look at it as we're talking about the story now, and of course all the questions about what would have happened if the other situation would have occurred. Well, here's another important question, by the way, that's being asked right now as we speak by many people. How did this 20-year-old would-be assassin get close enough to be able to fire an AR-15 at the former president? So to do this, I also want to illustrate it for you. So let me show you a map of the location where the incident occurred. There it is. Put it up if you can, Vic. There it is. See it? Okay. Now, look at the distances here, all right? You see that red box on the left? Red box on the left of your screen, that little red box that's rectangular or whatever there? That's where the shooter was crouched when he took the shot. And that's roughly about 100 yards, essentially a football field, from where the president was, which is that blue line that we have for you there. That's essentially a football field from where the guy shot, from where the president was, right there in that other red box. See that other red box at the bottom? That's where the president was speaking from. Now, keep that number, 100 yards, in your head. Why? Because now I'm going to tell you another number, 600 yards. That's the range of an AR-15, 600 yards, according to military technical technicians' tests, right? Six times the distance. So why then did the Secret Service not evacuate that building where that red little box is over there? Why didn't they evacuate that building where the shooter was if he was only 1/6 the distance of what his gun could shoot at? Here's another thing. Why wasn't the would-be assassin crawling in broad daylight with a rifle on top of the only building that was near the stage spotted? How could they not see him? Why didn't they see him? And I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist here, okay? I'm just pointing out facts. Actually, the dude, the shooter, that would-be assassin was seen. He was seen. Listen to what several Trump supporters who were in the audience say they saw. Go.
We're like, hey, man, there's guy on the roof with a rifle. And the police were like, huh, what? You know, like they didn't know what was going on. You know, we're like, hey, right here on the roof. We can see him from right here. We see him. You know, he's crawling. And next thing you know, I'm thinking to myself, why is Trump still speaking? Why have they not pulled him off the stage? I'm standing there pointing at him for, you know, 2-3 minutes. Secret Service is looking at us from the top of the barn. I'm pointing at that roof, just standing there like this. And next thing you know, 5 shots ring out.
I mean, you do have to ask yourself. I know part of it is maybe strategy. Weaponry has changed. When they instituted these Secret Service rules, it was probably 10 or 30 years ago. They didn't have weapons that could go 600 yards. But here's another important point. Now, I think this is relevant. There's going to be a lot of attention on the Trump shooting, as well there should be. But guess what? What happened to Mr. Trump is not unusual. Not unusual. A lot of you who are watching us right now from different parts of the world may not know this, but if you live in America, you're 26 times more likely to be shot and killed than the citizen of any other developed country in the world. 26 times more apt to be killed if you live in the United States as a citizen. Every day in the U.S., 327 people are shot. And of those 327, 117 of those die. And for every 100 people who live in this country, there are 121 firearms. For every 100 people, there are 121 firearms. And if you ask them, they all say they need them. In fact, statistically speaking, you're more apt to be shot in the United States. This may be a more dangerous place. Statistically speaking, you're more apt to be shot here than you would be if you lived in most war zones, including Afghanistan for 20 years and now Ukraine. You're literally safer there than you are here, statistically speaking. Think about that. Now let's talk politics. And don't think for one minute that this attempted assassination of Donald Trump is not going to skew this election his way, by the way, even further. First of all, the optics of Mr. Trump are nothing short of phenomenal. I mean, here's this guy who withstood this attack and then with blood running down his face in a, like a Rocky-like moment, holding his fist in the air, he raises it up and yells, fight, fight, fight. I mean, there's nobody in Hollywood who could have written something like this as good, right? As his followers are all chanting, USA, USA. I mean, need I say more? You've seen it with your own eyes. Those are optics. That's messaging. Now, let's compare that to his opponent. President Biden said that the NATO summit would be his crowning moment, that he was going to show the entire world that he is indeed strong and that he is capable. This was going to be it, baby. He was going to do it. And that is the message that the whole world would take away from this summit. Instead, this is what came out of this summit.
I wouldn't have picked Vice President Trump to be vice president, but I think she was not qualified to be president.
And now I want to hand it over to the president of Ukraine, who has as much courage as he has determination. Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin. President Putin. You can beat President Putin. President Zelensky.
crowning moment, the piece de resistance for the president of the United States, showing the whole world that he's in control, that he can lead the world. And he calls Zelensky Putin, and he calls his vice president, Vice President Trump. Kamala Harris became Trump. Zelensky became Putin. In his mind, the difference, folks, is night and day right now between one man and the other. Because of those two incidents that occurred during the past 72 hours, in that 72-hour span, messaging, optics, they're everything in American politics. And this will give Mr. Trump a huge advantage going into the Republican primary, the Republican convention, I should say. No question. No question. And I guarantee you that public opinion polls, which are going to be coming out in the next 2 or 3 days, sometimes it takes a week after an event like this to really be able to measure what an audience thinks. I guarantee you they will follow suit. They will say the same as I have just said. So when we come back, what's this all mean? We're going to be talking to an expert about what this means and how it's being seen internationally as well as domestically. Don't go away. We're going to be right back. Okay, with all that said, with the table set, as we like to say, I want to welcome you back. I'm Rick Sanchez. Joining us now from Ankara, Turkey, is Dr. Hasan Ünal. He is a renowned scholar and professor there of political science. Dr. Hasan, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Well, that's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So here's the situation, and it's pretty weird, right, that within this past 72-hour period from, like, Friday through the weekend, suddenly we have a NATO that is so damaged because they had this important message they wanted to get out in their 75th annual celebration or commemoration, and it was not even, most people, if you ask people around the world about NATO, they don't even know what happened. They have no idea what their message is. Instead, they came away with, God bless them, a president of the United States who was our president, but that fumbled and mumbled and forgot everything and basically became a humiliated man who was a bit of a laughingstock. So that's that. And you have the other side, where you have the candidate for president of the United States and Donald Trump, who during an assassination attempt has never looked stronger. So if you're NATO, right? Professor, you're looking at no messaging. The candidate you like because he's your NATO cheerleader looking horrible, and the candidate you don't like because he's not been kind to NATO looking like an absolute hero and a man who's about to win the election. What do you do? And did I get it right?
Oh, certainly. I mean, putting aside Trump's, Biden's blunders, okay, all his fumbling and mumbling, when you go into the nitty-gritty details of the NATO meeting and the NATO declaration, summit declaration and all that, what you see basically is a declaration saying that they're gearing up for a world war, or at least you can say NATO is getting ready to basically escalate the conflict in Ukraine up to a certain point. But we don't know what that certain point is. And when you study the whole text, which I have, then you don't see any opening for diplomacy. For God's sake, you know, during the course of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, when the United States had a certain edge over the nuclear weapons, you know, in comparison with the Soviet Union then, the minute the crisis broke out, the diplomacy basically went into action. But since the outbreak of the conflict in Ukraine, there has been no diplomatic opening, despite the fact that the Russian side has been making all the gestures and also putting out solution proposals, if like, and you know, not least the fact that you know, they agreed to an overall resolution of the crisis just a couple of months after it broke out, when they agreed to the Istanbul deal, when the Turkish government basically stitched things together for the Ukrainians and the Russians to talk to each other.
And so, what happened? I mean, let's not stop there. That's important. The Istanbul deal fell apart. Why? Who was responsible for killing them?
Because Johnson, you know, the Boris Johnson of the United Kingdom at the time, who was the prime minister, under advice from Biden, Team Biden, just flew over to Kiev and basically told Zelensky that there's no time for diplomacy, no deal, nothing until after the Ukrainian side and the Western side, of course, inflicts a strategic defeat on Russia. This is actually boggling. You know, how are you going to inflict a strategic defeat on a nuclear power, which is now more powerful than the United States, Britain, and France put together in terms of nuclear bombs?
Nuclear warheads. That's why this is so interesting to speak to you, because you probably can grasp the Turkish perspective for us. And what is the Turkish perspective? Because you're an insider. You're a part of NATO. You're part of the guys who say they're the good guys, right? NATO's supposed to be the good guys, and all the other countries, Russia, bad. China, bad. India, bad. Iran, bad. All these other countries are supposed to be, you know, South Africa, bad. Nigeria, bad. Brazil, bad. This is the perspective that you, as a Turkish citizen, is supposed to have if you represent the country that is representative of NATO. Do you feel that way, or do you find that a frustrating perspective?
Well, it is the second you have said, basically a frustrating perspective, because actually there's no perspective for peace and reconciliation. So what does that mean? You can't basically inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. If you try it, then you would be provoking a nuclear war. A nuclear clash would mean perhaps the end of the whole world, if not, you know. And then what are you basically doing? Okay, there would be a lot of ways to start negotiations and peace deals and secret behind the curtain deals. For instance, this is what I learned when I studied in Britain. You know, diplomacy is something very important, and it is normally conducted behind the curtain. Okay, now we have a British government who which is on its high horse, doesn't want to deal with anybody, including Russia, Putin, anybody, including even, I mean, they're not even dealing with the Chinese either. So from Turkish perspective, no such attitude like this one can be actually condoned and supported. So the Turkish government did the right thing as the conflict broke out. Basically, it said, okay, you can go on with your sanctions, with your blah, blah, but I'm not part of it. Part of NATO.
How do you read it? Let me ask you this question. I think this is a fascinating question. I can't wait to hear your answer. It's now looking more and more, perhaps more than ever today, like the next president of the United States will again be Donald Trump. Do you believe that Donald Trump's policies from the standpoint of NATO geopolitics will be superior to those of Biden's? Or do you think that the so-called deep state, in quotations, will do with him the same thing they've done with Biden?
Well, let me first point out one thing, actually. In my op-eds, which I write for a foreign news and analysis portal once or twice a week, I predicted the assassination attempt, and I clearly said that the deep state of the United States might actually engineer something of that sort to prevent Trump taking over one way or the other. You know, they've got to do whatever they can to prevent him from basically being elected. And I think the day, just as the assassination took place, the assistants in the portal called me up and said that they were putting together all my, at least excerpts from my writings, and I shared it on my Twitter site, I think yesterday or the day before.
Yeah,
so
I saw
it. Expected this. I expected this because Trump is someone who is out to basically bring down the whole deep state and whatever the deep state basically represents. He's against the economic policies that has been pursued by the United States governments without any questioning, although in many aspects, the economic policies aren't bringing in welfare, aren't bringing in what the people actually expect. In the United States, in Europe, as well as in Turkey, but more importantly, in terms of the U.S. foreign policy, Trump is completely different from the all the administration that has been basically in power over decades.
But let me stop you just for a moment. Then, but that wasn't the case when he was president. He had Pompeo in there. I mean, come on, Pompeo. I don't think there's anybody in this world today who, maybe Bolton is worse, but these are people who are neocons and who believe wholeheartedly in everything that Biden has been doing. So how can you be so sure that those guys won't get in there again and control him like they did the last time?
Well, none of us can basically say anything with any certainty about that. So there are all these deep state elements all over the place who can actually try to manipulate him, and still, from now onwards, what other plan do they have in their their mind? None of us can tell.
Yeah, and there's also this. I mean, Trump's relationship with Netanyahu was even more cozy than Biden's relationship with Netanyahu, and that's saying a lot, because I've never seen any president of the United States who's been more in bed with the prime minister of Israel than Biden.
Well, yes, but there are nuances. For instance, on the one hand, he's maybe more pro-Israeli and more pro-Netanyahu or whatever than any other U.S. president. But at the same time, he talks about evacuating Iraq, evacuating Syria, and he's very, very critical about all these endless wars that the United States basically fomented and also got involved in across the Middle East, Afghanistan. And don't forget, I mean, the Afghan deal was his deal that Biden seized upon, perhaps rightly or wrongly, but, you know, he was trying to bring all the U.S. Women and men home.
Yes,
and he was also critical of those wars, endless wars, on the because he was basically saying that the United States were wasting its resources for endless war, which was absolutely right. Now, again, on the question of the Ukrainian war, he is quite specific, and he says if he'd been in power, then there would have been no war,
and he's going to end it.
And now he said. Don't forget, after the NATO meeting, you obviously know what happened. Prime Minister of Hungary went down to see him in Mar-a-Lago, and then he said to Orbán that carry on with your peace initiative, and as soon as I basically take over, I'm going to stop this war in Ukraine. Whereas, look at all the others. You know,
yeah,
the Biden
is extremely
critical of Orbán, and the European ones are critical of him. And so on the one hand, you have all these progressive politics, politicians like Biden team, and then you have the Europeans, all of them, who are warmongers. And then they...
No, you're right. And listen, we're out of time, Professor, but I will say this to you. I'm glad I pushed you on that point, because I wanted to hear, well, that's my job, but I wanted to hear your explanation of how a Trump presidency would differ in essence from a Biden presidency. And I think you've given that analysis in a very fair and accurate way. So I appreciate
There's
your
another
time.
One, for yeah. instance.
If you can do it in 10 seconds, good, because we're out of time. Go ahead.
Well, even on China, he doesn't seem to come out with a suggestion for war with China, but he talks about trade wars.
Yes, and that is different. Well, Professor, we're out of time.
That is another news. Thank
you so much, sir, for taking time to join us. I look forward to talking to you again. You certainly are astute with these issues, and you've helped us very much. Thank you again, sir.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show. Remember, always try and do everything you can to look outside your own box. That's what we try to do here during this show. Truths, they don't live in little boxes. They're everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you next time.